Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, and at the controls is the maestro of this exciting orchestra, Jason Ruggiero.
Good to be here.
And our soon-to-be Dr. Garrett Britton is back with us this week to keep us up to date on everyone's UCLs, PCLs, ACLs, and W-2s.
Hey, how you doing?
He's not really an accountant, folks. That's a little hyperbole.
He just stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, that's
all. So, updating everyone on the Carlos Quinton saga. Apparently, according to the Twitter, Carlos Quinton had a good, productive conversation with Zach Greinke. Gentlemen, what do we think that conversation entailed?
I'm having trouble envisioning how a conversation would go when Zach Greinke walked out in a sling. I don't think that's a good start to that conversation.
I feel like that conversation's probably safer on Twitter. I hope they had a Twitter conversation.
Yeah.
140 characters. You gotta be to the point.
But even then, you know, it was like, if Quinton has to be really careful, because if he says like one thing to set Greinke off, Greinke's gonna be like, you know, it's hard to type 140 characters with one arm.
Oh man,
hope you have fun playing the next few months.
Enjoy it. All right, well, we're gonna have a little change up to the show this week. Our good friend Bob, the Irish Bulldog, the Red Snapper, he's gonna be a little less available. Bob's gonna have a little scaled back role over the next couple months. If you're not friends with Bob, you don't know Bob in real life. Real life Bob is an exceptional human being who also happens to be a high school baseball coach at a local school. And it was taking up quite a bit of his time trying to juggle covering an organization as well as being a grown-up and managing a team high schoolers.
And now he's going to be taking on some additional
coaching duties.
He's
going to be coaching the summer league team.
I don't know if you're aware of this, Bob. I know Dr. Garrett isn't. Bob has... He had quite a baseball accomplishment this last week with his team.
He threw their team threw a no-hitter this week, didn't they?
Right, two pitchers in one game combined to throw a no-hitter.
And didn't they end up lost that game?
They lost the game.
That's like a 1970s Pittsburgh Pirates Doc Ellis story right there. That's what's tough.
That's kind of like that badge of shame, you know?
Yeah.
Especially Bob was a former pitcher himself, so it's like got to be a great accomplishment.
But that was
my kids threw a no hitter, but we lost the game.
But we lost.
The memory is like forever scarred by that.
So this week, we're going to be going Bobless, but keep your eyes peeled. I'm sure Bob will be posting some things. You know, he goes to games all year long and he'll be keeping us up to date on what he goes to see, I'm sure. So, this week we will be getting our medical updates from Dr. Garrett. We'll be talking Cleveland and Pittsburgh. And at the end of this episode, we have a fantastic interview with Ben Jedlovic. If you're not familiar with Ben Jedlovic, he is a contributing writer at ESPN. You may have seen him on the MLB Network. He's also the co-author of The Fielding Bible, Volume 3. And we got to sit down with him for almost an hour. And just talk baseball with him. It's a fantastic conversation. We're going to play part one of it today. We're going to break it up into two parts. So if you want to listen to that at the end of the episode, it'll be there tacked on at the end. So let's get right into it with our medical updates from Dr. Garrett.
Is there a doctor in the house?
I'm not a doctor yet, but I play one on the internet.
All right. Well, it wasn't as tough a week on Cleveland as last week was, but it was still pretty hard. As Cabrera, he's had a busy week. He was scratched from Sunday's game.
Because he fell down the steps?
He fell in the dugout and injured his left wrist.
Yeah.
Nothing too serious. They're calling it a mild contusion.
And he's played since then.
Yes, he played.
Had a game... Well, a go-ahead single, I guess it would be.
Right.
Against the White Sox.
On Monday, trying to steal, injured his right quadriceps.
Yes.
I feel awful laughing, by the way, but when it rains, it pours for you guys. You're just, like, I'm not laughing at the injury itself, but I'm laughing at just the bad luck you guys have had to start off the year.
Yeah.
It's been tough.
One thing after the other. So now... Thursday, they had an off day, which is today. Yesterday, they had a day game that he didn't play in.
Right.
And the day before that, they had a rainout. So he's got snuck in 3 days off there for him.
So questionable start for Friday's game.
Right, against the Royals.
Yeah. Carlos Santana returned Tuesday, and he took that ball to the left thumb.
Yeah, back at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and he's he seemed to be doing all right.
Yeah, and actually he made a great defensive play, which he threw behind a runner at second base on a failed bunt attempt. Totally changed the inning. It was the kind of defensive play, you know, we've been waiting for from Carlos Santana. But now...
But now he's a questionable start for Friday due to an illness.
Yeah. After the game was canceled on Wednesday.
Yeah.
They've had so many cancellations lately, it's hard to keep them straight. He told reporters that he really wasn't feeling that well. And then the game was canceled Tuesday. And then Wednesday's day game, he sat out also because Lou Marson got activated. And he made the start.
That's right. So hopefully he'll be back Friday and...
Yep, swinging that hot bat for the Indians. They need him in their batting order there. He's been probably the most consistent guy they've had all year.
Yeah, I think he hit a home run, went 2 for 5.
That sounds right. I know he's slugging like 700 right now in the season.
Something ridiculous.
Yeah.
So we'll hope
hopefully he
for
makes
his health.
Quick recovery from that. What do you know about the Michael Bourne finger laceration?
Well, he lacerated his right index finger back on April 15th.
Yeah.
He slid headfirst into first. And sliced his finger open. It took sutures to close it. So those sutures are coming out, and they suspect that he won't need a rehab assignment.
Okay.
So it's looking like a return April 30th or... soon after that.
Yeah, he's eligible April 30th, and I think they're really hoping he's ready then.
Yeah, and, you know, if they came out with him not needing a rehab assignment, they're probably pretty confident.
Yeah, I think he's going to get the stitches out today, maybe.
Yeah.
Hoping to, anyways.
And then Brett Myers.
Ah, yes.
There he is.
There he is.
Can't get away from it. He's been having some difficulty.
If you listen,
not just in life, but I mean in baseball.
If you listen to him, he's been having it since spring training, right?
Yeah, yeah. This has been going on for some time, and I'm not really sure what their play is. They're calling it a UCL sprain.
First, they were calling it tendonitis, weren't they?
Yeah, they were kind of tiptoeing around it. They came out yesterday, said UCL. So
now, what's the gray area between UCL sprain and Tommy John surgery?
Well, that's
what I think of whenever I hear UCL sprain.
And that's what you should. That's really what you should think. And especially because this is turning into a chronic situation. This isn't something that started yesterday and, you know, he's resting and bouncing back from it. So, you know, I think this is how a typical progression goes. He may be headed for Tommy John. They're not going to say it this week.
Sure. Because they're going to do he's going to take 2 weeks where he never picks up a baseball and he's not going to even think about returning for a month. And then what's going to happen, I'm guessing, is a month from now, they're going to say, well, we're going to send him to get a second opinion, but he might need Tommy John. And this is what drives people crazy sometimes, because they say, well, let's just start the process now.
Right.
It's a year-long process.
It's going to take a while.
You know, and we don't want to waste 2 months, you know, but from the player's perspective, if there's any way he can not miss a year, you know, they want to take that opportunity.
Right.
So.
Right. So we'll keep an eye. He was placed on the 15-day DL. So we'll keep an eye on him. Then over to Detroit, Al Albuquerque left Wednesday's game in the seventh inning after his hip tightened up on him.
Was that before? I didn't follow the exact box score, but I just wondering if that was before or after a bad outing. like was he having trouble finding, you know, like it was a Brett Myers thing? Like, man, I just can't find the zone. Oh, my hip's hurting all of a sudden.
I think that's probably how it went.
boy, Jim, my hip's really bothering me.
And, you know, they're being real vague about it. They're just calling it a right hip knot. A pinching in his groin. They're being real vague about it. So he's questionable for Friday's game. I expect him to return. I don't think it's anything too serious.
If you were stressed out at all by Detroit's bullpen last season, it has not gotten better for you this year.
And then Ramon Santiago was actually sent to the hospital last Saturday for dehydration, which is interesting to keep in mind that, you know, this is a physical sport and something that seems trivial, you know, just drink water.
Right.
You know, can put players down.
Well, and even, you know, spending 9 innings standing in the sun.
Right. You know,
takes a lot of water out of you.
You sweat quite a bit sometimes in baseball, even standing, just, you know, manning your position, even if a ball doesn't get hit to you.
It's early in the season, and some may argue that, you know, a player isn't to their peak yet.
Right.
For the season. He's questionable for Friday.
And I'll tell you this too, on the Facebook, I saw that some kind of crazy, ridiculous percentage of people, just generally speaking, are all dehydrated. So I've been drinking more water, feel a lot better, generally speaking. Got a little pep in my step.
So
though.
Ramon, it would be fair to say that Ramon Santiago has opened your eyes.
He has,
to this crisis.
Yes, it's good. I hope he's on the mend, drinking plenty of bottles of water.
He may have saved your life. News from Thursday, Justin Verlander was taken out.
Yeah, just this afternoon.
For a blister on his right thumb. Must be one heck of a blister.
Well, and he was relieved by former Seawolf, Bruce Rondon.
Former Erie Seawolf, Bruce Rondon.
Who was called up when Octavio Dotel went on the disabled list earlier this week.
Right, for a right elbow issue. Now, he had some shoulder inflammation earlier this month that he recovered from, but now we're getting into this elbow issue. So we'll keep an eye on him. This, too, it's very nonspecific. We'll just have to see what's going on with that.
And in case you were curious about Rondon made his first appearance of the season today, correct?
Yes, he came in the eighth inning to relieve Justin Verlander. He proceeded to blow the save and give up three hits and allow one run in one inning.
Well, and here's the crazy thing too, when you look at his pitch counts and what he was doing with the ball, it was what we have. He had no called strikes. He had three swinging strikes.
Which, for a guy that throws that hard, is not going to cut it.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
You're throwing 100 miles an hour, and you can only induce three swinging strikes. And he had eight strikes that people either put in play for hits or fouled off. That's not a good ratio for Bruce Rondon. I mean, he only had five balls, which is a step in the right direction for his other problems. But it makes you wonder if by trying to control his wildness, he's lost some of his movement on his stuff, you know, because now he's getting hit pretty hard.
And everyone will tell you, you watch baseball long enough, you know one thing that everybody in the majors can do is hit a ball that's going straight.
Right. So. No matter how hard you throw it. So he only gave up one run, and he actually even faced a batter in the ninth inning before they pulled him. So...
And then Detroit fans, as I'm sure they're all aware, got to see Phil Koch do what Phil Koch does best.
They pulled Bruce Rondon to be shown Phil Koch's 1 1/3 innings for four earned runs and one hit.
So even though it might not look like anything's wrong with Phil Koch, I think we all know what's wrong with Phil Koch.
Well, and, you know, you look at this Tigers bullpen. Now Albuquerque's hurt. Dotel's hurt. Rondon doesn't give you any help in this outing. I mean, it's his first appearance, but obviously you're putting him in the eighth inning of a game that you're ahead in or tied. You're tied. You're hoping for more than a blown save and three hits and a run.
Yeah.
You know, Jim Leland doesn't have much to go to there. You know, you might think, why are you putting a guy in for his first appearance in that situation? But he doesn't have anything.
Yeah.
He's trying to save Phil Koch for the save.
It's that bullpen. I just look at it. It gives me a headache. I can't imagine how Jim Leland must feel. So do we have anything else going on in Detroit?
No, that's it for Detroit. Then over to Pittsburgh, who continues to make my job easy.
Unscathed.
I've had to scrounge.
Ridiculous.
Scrounge to find something to talk about for Pittsburgh. Francisco Liriano, he's on schedule to return mid-May.
And if you didn't see Liriano's most recent rehab assignment in Altoona, don't go look at it. Don't
save your eyes.
Rough. Don't look at the numbers because you'll cry.
And then Charlie Morton, who's recovering
good
from
old Charlie Morton
Tommy
appearance.
John.
Now, Chuck, he'll be a little more inspiring if you go look at his most recent outing.
Made a double-A start on Tuesday
yep.
for Altoona, and he's looking pretty good.
So when do you think, is there, what's the timetable on Charlie Morton's return?
I think they were calling that May also.
How, not to get out of sorts here, I know you're going to talk about the Pirates in a few minutes, but what's the outlook for Charlie Morton this season?
Well, it's been interesting because we came into it looking at basically just trying to fill that fifth spot. You know, we kind of had that battle between McPherson and Jeff Locke in spring training. And so I think it's still, you know, we know we have AJ at the top. We have Wandy. I don't know about James McDonald, honestly. I mean, if he keeps pitching the way that he is, he could be a very replaceable player if someone's pitching good enough to stick in the rotation. You know, if you watch James McDonald's starts, it really is an up and down inning by inning. There are some innings where he'll zip through 10, 12 pitches. He's got the side out. And then there are other innings where he's laboring to get through them. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's probably one or two spots where if guys are coming back and pitching well, that they could definitely work their way into a rotational spot.
They're looking at mid-May for his return.
Okay. So yeah, that's kind of where I was going with that, you know.
Jeff Locke's spot is definitely open for anyone who can outpitch Jeff Locke. I don't know about the leash on James McDonald. I haven't seen anyone say anything disparaging, I guess, probably because, number one, they want to keep him in the right mindset for pitching.
Sure.
But I'm sure if Liriano came back and started popping the ball in the mid all of a sudden, that they'd have no problem trying to figure out a way to work him in there. So it'll be something to keep an eye on. So is that it on the medical field, the
that
triage?
That is it.
All right. I like it. Hey, Pittsburgh, no one getting hurt. Staying healthy, winning games.
Like,
nice job, boys.
Only two of those players might be on the major league roster if they were healthy.
Oh, man. I'm just glad everyone's staying hydrated in Pittsburgh. That's all I care about. Yeah. No dehydration.
No dehydration problems.
Well, let's get into what's been going on in Pittsburgh.
It's not warm enough there to have a dehydration.
It's not. No, yeah. You just go pull some of the icicles off the stands there. You'll be hydrated. It's been a while since we've talked. I can't remember the last time we recorded. It was probably about a week and a half ago, so we've had a lot going on. After we recorded last, the Pirates are getting ready to go into a 10-game series against the Reds, Cardinals, and Braves. That was a series. I was getting ready to sell my motorcycle, and I was talking to the guy who was taking care of the title, and he was a big Pirates fan. I saw all the memorabilia that was around, and I go, you know, how are you feeling about the Pirates? I know they're not off to a great start. And he goes, look at this schedule, look at these games. I wouldn't be surprised if we went 0-10 for the next 10 games. That's what this guy said. And I kind of, at that point, I'm like, well, yeah, you know, the Braves are playing really well. It's kind of hard to present a counterpoint to that argument. We came out of that series 7-2. There was one of the Cards games was postponed. It was rained out. And we looked like a competitive ball team. I mean, watching the Pirates the first 9 games, I think they ended up being like 3-6 after their first 9. And all the Pirates fans are up in arms like, oh, this is going to be an awful season. And then that 10-game stretch, we came out 7-2. And, I mean, we were hitting well. We were getting big hits when we needed to get big hits. You know, the pitchers have been fantastic this season. The back end of that bullpen has been lights out. I don't think Greeley's given up a run yet this season. I mean, everybody was contributing. We were clicking. So now I think it's just a matter of doing that for two halves of the season at this point, after the last two epic collapses that we've had. So since then, we've had AJ Burnett, who went nearly perfect and almost had a no-hitter to boot. He ended up, I think he ended up pitching seven innings in that game. Another great outing from him. Against Atlanta, I was you know, watching the Atlanta series intently because I think the Braves are going to be one of the tougher teams from the National League. And BJ and Justin Upton, all series long, were just awful to the umpires. Awful to the umpires. There was not a called strike three that they thought was a strike at all. And they were chirping the whole, every at bat, they were chirping about everything. I mean, they were just nonstop about it. And they ended up, you know, in a couple disagreements. BJ actually got thrown out of the Friday night game. And the way the interaction looked like it went, he got called out on strike three, took a couple steps away, and you could see him kind of say something out of the corner of his mouth to the umpire, just loud, you know, one of those things where you just loud enough so the umpire can hear it. And the umpire almost like brushed him, like literally almost brushed him off with his hand. It was like, he just like, whatever, get out of here, sit down. And BJ did not like that in the least, and he went off.
Well, and BJ's always been a bit of
a wee bit of a hothead.
Yeah, so I think it'd be interesting to see when he's, you know, with his brother, if like that makes it worse now, if they like kind of feed off of each other. Yeah. You know, like BJ feels like he's right more often now because he's probably going in the dugout and his brother's like, yeah
you were getting squeezed up there.
No way that was a strike.
No way. Oh, BJ, that argument was, it was a good one. So that was kind of entertaining to see all weekend. Just no one got a called strike three that in their eyes was an actual strike, and they were flipping out about all that. But I think that's just Pittsburgh working the zone. Good for you, Buccos. Keep up the good work. Starling Marte
was not working the zone.
Starling Marte, media darling, does not. He swings at anything that's close. He and this is before today's stats. He's hitting 321 prior to today's game. In the last 10 games, he's only drawn one walk. And Tom Singer actually had a really good stat on Twitter today. He said that Marte is hitting 468. He's 29 for 62 when he puts the ball in play. Which, if you're not familiar with baseball statistics, when you're putting the ball in play at that rate, at some point that's going to stop. You're every time you hit the ball, half the time that you hit the ball, it's not going to find a home. And I'm just waiting because I know it's going to happen. At some point, it's going to happen where some of these balls that Marte is getting to land aren't going to land. And his batting average is going to take a dip. And fans in Pittsburgh are going to be angry about it. And they're probably going to voice their anger in not such a polite way.
And then
way.
It's not going to be funny that he only has one walk
in the last 10 games.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great when you're racking up, you know.
Yeah, nobody cares.
15, 20 hits. Let's just keep it going. Jeez. So, you know, he's off to a great start. I don't think he's a prototypical leadoff hitter. He's just not. You know, he's not going to be setting the table for anyone behind him. But I think he's doing a great job of being the type of hitter that he is. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I just don't think it's something that you'll want at the top of your lineup forever. So, continuing on, Stetson Alley is still raking in West Virginia. He's hitting 367. Six homers.
I refuse to acknowledge these stats.
20 RBI and 79 at bats. And he's walking 11 walks, 24 strikeouts. Stetson Alley.
I refuse to acknowledge those stats.
Is it entered
into the logbook?
Is it too early to start referring to him as future Hall of Famer Stetson Alley?
Yes.
Too soon?
It's too early to refer to him as double A player.
Maybe
Stetson Alley.
As Altoona Curve All Star. Well, I'm gonna be keeping my eye on Stetson Alley. I might have a new man crush now, Stetson Alley. You keep raking down there, buddy.
Oh my goodness.
You keep doing your thing. Stolmy Pimentel, Joel Hanrahan trade. He is still doing what he does. He's pitching really well this season, and we're really happy about that. He's thrown 23 and a third innings. He has a 0.39 ERA on the year. He's walked 13, a little high, struck out 23. His last outing in Erie, he threw six innings, no earned runs, gave up two hits, four strikeouts, no walks. So hopefully that walking trend is going to be going on the downside. And the last thing I want to touch on, Garrett Cole's last outing against the Louisville Bats on April 21st. through four innings, struck out two, gave up a hit. The alarming trend was the five walks that he surrendered. He threw 85 pitches, 49 were for strikes. So just kind of keeping an eye on Gerrit Cole's control and command of his pitches. I didn't get to watch that last outing, so I didn't see whether he was missing with his breaking balls, what was going on with the counts. But just something to keep an eye on, five walks in four innings, and you know that one of the things they want to work on is the control of his secondary pitches and making sure that he can command his fastball in the strike zone. So that's it from Pittsburgh. Ready to move on to Chief Wahoo's Trap Time there?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always a lot to talk about in Cleveland. As Dr. Garrett went over earlier, the injury train continues. Michael Bourne, Brett Myers, Lou Marson returning, minor injuries to Santana and Cabrera. I mean, we could go on and on. It just seems to be kind of a relentless thing with the Indians this year, and you hope it's just not going to be one of those years that you look back and it's just like lost to injury. You know, I mean, it's already been a month, and I wonder, you know, that lineup that Terry Francona put out the first day, I think that lineup has maybe appeared like together, it can't be more than five times.
Yeah,
you know, and they haven't yet. Even they still do not have, you know, that 25 man roster that they wanted to have, because in the beginning they were playing that ridiculous Carlos Carrasco suspension game, you know, and Giambi was on the DL with his quote unquote back injury and everything, and you know, they're still waiting to have the roster set up the way they want it to be set up. And I think it's going to be interesting also to see how Terry Francona reacts. You know, most managers have like a kind of a cutoff date, whether it be the middle of May or May 30th, you know, or 40 games in or whatever, where they say, okay, I gave you a shot, kid. I got to do something else now. But this team hasn't been together for 40 games, you know? So it's like, you wonder how long will Terry Francona and Chris Antonetti let things run out, just hoping, you know, it's like, well, we haven't had our true lineup together long enough yet. Because you do see moments when the most of the lineup is there that the offense does look good, you know, or like Jason Kipnis the other night got a hit with runners in scoring position, drove in a run. Later, he stole second and third. You know, it's like Drew Stubbs is starting to hit now, ever since Michael Bourne went on the DL. You know, so you see these signs of like what could be, and it's just, you know, I think it was a big shot too to the team when Michael Bourne went on the DL, because he was, I think, their most consistent hitter to that point.
Yeah.
Nick Swisher hadn't really gotten fired up yet. Cabrera and Kipnis were struggling, and then you lose the one guy that was kind of sparking things and doing what he was supposed to be doing at the top of the order, and you lose him. And then you put the rotation struggles on top of it. You just get this team that is so inconsistent and so up and down, a roller coaster every night. I mean, Masterson and McAllister have been good. Masterson's been great at times. Other than that, this rotation, they've already used eight different pitchers. It's not even the end of April yet. You know, Jimenez, I mean, I don't even know. He had, you know, a really horrible start where he didn't even last two innings and gave up seven runs, and then a really good start, but it was against the Astros, you know. And Andy and I were talking before the podcast that all spring when Jimenez was throwing well, supposedly he was throwing two bullpens in between every start. And when the season started, they went back to the traditional one bullpen. Well, now after that disastrous two inning seven run performance, they said you're going to go back to your two bullpens. I mean, it can't hurt. All we can do is hope that that's the magic, you know, charm that solves Ubaldo Jimenez's problems, and we'll all look back and say, oh, why didn't we think of this 2 years ago?
That's the old Jose Bautista, why don't you just pull them all?
Right, exactly. So, you know, and now Myers is hurt, which isn't necessarily a horrible thing, honestly. He's replaced by Corey Kluber. But at least I know what I'm going to get from Corey Kluber. I'm going to get five or six unspectacular innings, and he might give up five runs, but he also might give up three and keep the team in the game. I at least, when Corey Kluber steps on the mound, have a pretty good idea what's going to happen. And that's what this team needs right now, is at least someone that you expect them to do something and they can go out and do it. Because right now, Ubaldo and Myers and all these guys, it's like you have no idea. Are they going to go one inning or are they going to go seven innings? Kazmir, you know, he had his one start there, which didn't really go well, but it got clouded by the fact that they scored 19 runs that game. I think he only lasted like three innings. So it'll be interesting this weekend against the Royals to see him in his second start.
Kazmir, his pitch count was getting ridiculous early on.
Right, so they pulled him because it was like, well, we scored 19 runs. Yes,
yeah, that was the game where he had an 8-run lead and didn't end up with a win.
Forget it, kid. You know, so we'll see what happens. This whole rotation, the thing is, they don't have many options. Bauer is clearly not ready. Carrasco, you know, has his suspension looming. Some people are wondering why they haven't appealed that suspension. It seems to be the consensus is they haven't appealed it because they can still call him up if they need him and appeal the suspension and he can pitch. So they're not doing that because they need him as that emergency starter, because it's not going to be Daisuke. It's not going to be Giovanni Soto. They had to call up Fernando Nieve the other day just in case.
We're digging deep.
And then he got designated the next day and cleared waivers. So it's like, you know, what does that say about him? The offense is pretty similar to the rotation. Ups and down, fits and starts. You have no idea you're going to get 19 runs or you're going to get none. It's nice to see Jason Kipnis starting to get hits. He's not really like barreling the ball up with a lot of power, but he's getting hits. He's had a lot of, you know, warning track shots, and those have now turned into some singles and finally a hit with runners in scoring position. Cabrera had a game winning hit the other night. He was struggling with runners in scoring position. So, you know, it's the only guy on this team that's doing more than what you expected of him is Mark Reynolds, who's almost hitting 300 and is not striking out at the prolific rate you expect. So now all of a sudden Mark Reynolds is hitting third the other night, you know, and that's not what we want. That looks like last year's team as opposed to Mark Reynolds hitting sixth or seventh in the lineup, you know. But when you lose Bourne and you lose Cabrera and Kipnis and Santana, all of a sudden it's like, well,
someone's got a hit.
Okay, Mark, you're up, kid. The one thing that's gone really well is the bullpen. Brian Shaw has looked amazing. He's looking like he's going to justify this trade, whether or not Trevor Bauer ever pans out. I mean, he looks like a closer, and nothing he throws is straight. Everything is like
his,
a cutter.
His cutter is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal.
And this is amazing, really, when you think about it. How horrible this rotation is, how many innings this bullpen has logged. They've thrown 19 consecutive scoreless innings. And we're not talking about, like, guys going out and pitching one inning. Like, we're talking about moments when Cody Allen has to go out and pitch, like, three innings.
Yeah, to make up for Scott Kazmir's two on the starter.
Right,
whatever.
Or Ubaldo's, you know, one and a third or whatever. I mean, that's impressive, you know. You just hope they're not going to run them out.
Yeah.
Because they're using them so much. But the interesting thing is, they're still using an 8-man bullpen because of the versatility of guys like Rayburn and Aviles. They're able to carry that extra guy.
Yeah.
Which is really helping, because I know I've been watching the games and it's like, oh, he's going to go to the bullpen again. And you're thinking, who's he going to put in? And it always just seems like there's another guy out there. You know, there's another guy that didn't pitch last night. So the bullpen has really been the strength of this team, and it's kept them in games, you know, whether it's a 3-2 game that they finally scraped together a decent start, you know, and the bullpen can come in and shut it down. Chris Perez has been walking the high wire like usual, but he's been getting it done to this point. Although his bases loaded game against the Astros, oh,
that stresses me out. He's one of my fantasy closers. It
yeah, me too.
Makes my heart hurt.
Yeah, down on the farm, you know, Tyler Naquin continues to just pound the ball. You know, here's a guy people are wondering about. Does he have the bat to play a corner spot if he doesn't have the defensive ability to play center, which so far he's proving he can play center, and he's proving he's got some pop in his bat as well. I had his stats here. Let's see, he's hitting 307 with a 440 slugging, which is not at the level we thought we'd see from Tyler Naquin. He's got 5 doubles already. Francisco Lindor continues to hit well. The Mudcats really haven't been much of an offensive powerhouse, but Francisco Lindor is hitting 309, 382 on base, and a 456 slugging with 4 doubles and 3 triples and 7 stolen bases. So, you know, he continues to impress. TJ House had a nice start the other night and kind of started this whole when is TJ House going to be in Cleveland kind of thing. Because, you know, some of these people, and you can't blame them, they're saying, so what if TJ House isn't ready? I'd rather watch TJ House get lit up than Ubaldo.
Yeah.
You know, at least there's a chance TJ House could go out and throw a decent game. You know, a lot of people, there's no hope in their minds for Ubaldo anymore. Some other guys that have done well, Chun Chen, who was a guy who was more highly regarded last year and just had a complete power outage. The power has reappeared so far in Akron, which he's repeating that level. But so far this season, Chen's got 4 doubles, a triple, and 3 home runs in 17 games. And this is a guy that used to be a catcher. And then I was like, well, we'll make him first baseman. And now he's playing like a lot of DH. And, you know, it's like, you're not going to get to the big leagues, kid, as a first baseman and really not as a DH unless you've got some power. So he's kind of doing some work to reestablish his value. And since the rotation's so bad, I'll just note Trevor Bauer had a pretty good start the other night where he only went 5 innings, but gave up 2 runs, only 2 walks, and 8 strikeouts. And that's, again, people are kind of pushing, just bring Bauer up. Like, they'd rather watch Bauer try to figure it out
than
to watch Ubaldo never able to remember how he ever did it for half of a season.
Just get shellacked for 2 innings.
It's like, at least, you know, that start Bauer made, you could see his toughness. You could see some signs of progress. Ubaldo just is this, he's depressing.
He looks like, and honestly, he looks like a mechanical nightmare. They have those gifs on the internet of his mechanics in Colorado when he was throwing no hitters versus his mechanics in Cleveland, and you can just see his mechanics are a complete mess.
And not even that, he just, you watch Justin Masterson pitch right now, he's free and easy, nothing's getting him down. You know, a guy gets on base and it's just like, give me the ball back, like, whatever, I don't care, I'll get the next guy. Ubaldo looks out of sorts, concerned about himself, like worried about every pitch that he throws, no self-confidence. You know, he gets one runner on, and like one night he was great out of the windup. He got a runner on and walked 5 guys in a row, I think. 4 guys. I mean, he walked the bases full. He walked in a run at least. The next start, he was horrible out of the windup, and as soon as he got a runner on and was out of the stretch, he was lights out. I mean, I can't imagine being Mickey Callaway. It's like, okay, you're bad out of the stretch. Let's work on that. The next game, okay, you got the stretch down. Now let's go back to the windup.
Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, I always see Mickey Callaway making notes on a little pad. And the pad has to be all for Ubaldo. Yeah. It's just got to be like 99% Ubaldo Jimenez comments.
I bet during the Ubaldo starts, that's probably his resume that he's trying to update. Because
probably. Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of getting out of control. But they don't have any options.
Yeah.
You know? And you really can't pull the plug on someone after 4 or 5 starts. Here in a couple weeks, you can. You know, especially like Bauer's service issues will clear up here in the next couple of weeks. And then it's going to be, I think, a lot harder to just, as long as Bauer is at least pitching decent, it's going to be hard to keep him down and continue to watch a train wreck.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens there.
Well, thanks for the update with Cleveland, Jason.
Yeah, well, such as it is, I mean.
Or should we call it the downer date?
The roller coaster with Cleveland.
The downer date with Cleveland. So we're going to move on to an interview with Ben Jedlovic. He was very gracious with his time. It was a fantastic interview. If you are a fan of baseball in any capacity, listening to Jedlovic over the next 2 podcasts is going to be well worth it. He is a VP at Baseball Info Solutions. He is the author of The Fielding Bible, or a co-author of The Fielding Bible, Volume 3. and he's a regular contributor on ESPN.com, and he's been on MLB Network as well. A fantastic interview. So we're going to take it away with Ben Jedlovic. Well, we're joined today by Ben Jedlovic, the VP of Product Development and Sales at Baseball Info Solutions. Ben, how are you today?
I'm doing just fine.
Ben is also the co-author of The Fielding Bible, Volume 3, and a contributor at ESPN as well. Ben, is there anything else I'm missing?
No, that covers it.
You've got a plus-plus resume, so I don't want to leave anything out of there.
Well, I appreciate the kind words, but you're good.
Thanks. Well, how did you find yourself at Baseball Info Solutions?
Well, you see, I knew I had an interest in baseball and in the statistics side of the industry, and I kind of wanted to work doing this kind of work. And obviously, it's a very competitive industry, and it's hard to land something like that. So I was, through high school and college, developing my skills and crossing my fingers that something would work out, and doing what I could to develop, just analytically as a writer, as an analyst. As a baseball fan and a knowledgeable baseball fan as well, through college, and then crossed my fingers that something would work out. And I graduated from Rice in May 2008, and was looking to get into this industry, and nothing was imminent. And I started looking at outside of the baseball industry options, and before I ended up moving on into any of those outside of baseball industries, this opportunity came up at BIS it was an opening for a research analyst to work with John and work with the BIS team and support a number of the products and the publications that BIS is involved in. And it was perfect. It was exactly what I wanted to be working in. And I applied, and one thing led to another, and I ended up getting the job and starting there in mid-December. And, the rest is, just progressing at BIS and keeping up with everything that the exciting research that we're involved with, and getting to this point.
That's awesome. What kind of statistics does Baseball Info Solutions track?
It's a number of things. So we collect just regular play-by-play information as a starting point, but we have kind of prided ourselves on going beyond that and collecting innovative information that hasn't been tracked before. And along those lines, taking that information and analyzing it in ways that has never been analyzed before, because we've never had the data to analyze it before. So one of the things that when we first started the company, even now, that we've kind of prided ourselves on was collecting and analyzing defensive information, which up until maybe even the mid-90s or the 2000s, depending on when you want to draw the line, there wasn't much data to work with to analyze defensive fielders. You had assists, you had putouts, you had errors, but that didn't tell you nearly enough of the picture to get a good handle on who are the better or worse fielders from any sort of objective sense. So we started tracking, this was long before I got here, but started tracking things like where the ball landed, how hard, what kind of trajectory it took, how hard it was hit. And that's graduated recently to things like the timing batted balls, timing ground balls through the infield, and timing the hang time on fly balls and line drives. And that's kind of opened up a new wealth of information for us to analyze. So that's some of the ideas. A lot of our inspiration just comes from watching games and having conversations like this, where ideas come up of, well, what about this? Have you analyzed this aspect of the industry? Or have you ever thought about tracking this thing that happens every so often in games at the major league level? And we'll say, hey, that's useful information. Maybe there's a market for it, and there's some good information there. And so we'll try it out and follow up on it, and that's how we end up collecting a lot of the stuff that we collect today.
That's really interesting to hear, too, because it kind of sounds like there's almost a correlation between the big internet boom and computers and how technology progressed and how baseball progressed. Is there a correlation between how powerful computers are and how much data they can handle and what you're able to do now with baseball statistics like that?
Oh, absolutely. I think the computer age kind of coincides with the development of sabermetrics. If you go back to the 1970s when Bill James was adding up box scores by pencil and paper, right? There was a limit to how much Bill could do just on his own with a pencil and paper. Since then, Bill will be the first one to admit that he's not the most savvy with computers. he talks about all the time on his website. He talks about how his son can program databases for him and really progress his research a lot. So it's just kind of funny how it's reshaped the industry and how it's kind of evolved since the start of, you know, just the ideas that existed in the 70s and even before Bill started writing with, you know, Branch Rickey and Alan Barra and the Mills brothers and all of the, you know, the history of sabermetrics, the guys who started it all and take those ideas and run with it. Once we have better data and more comprehensive tools to work with that data.
Now, you mentioned a few moments ago that traditional baseball statistics, so people who maybe aren't big on the metrics, when they look at evaluating a player, they evaluate him based on errors and assists and putouts and traditional statistics like that. Now, looking at baseball from a more sabermetric standpoint, what statistic do you think is the most accurate measure of a player's defensive ability?
Well, I'm a little biased in this because we have our own defensive metrics, but we've done a lot of tests ourselves, and we think that our defensive metric, which we call defensive run saved, at least our most prominent defensive metric, defensive run saved, is we think it's the best. It analyzes 8 different components of player defense, from their ability to range and throw out runners, such as converting a ground ball, just fielding a ground ball and throwing the guy out. You know, based on exactly where the ball's hit and how hard it's hit and a number of other factors that may come into play. You know, the same thing goes for the outfield. So that's what we call the plus-minus component of defensive run save. Evaluating outfielders' arms, that's a second component. Evaluating corner infielders on their ability to handle bunts, middle infielders on double plays, catchers and pitchers on their ability to control the running game. As well as a couple other components, you know, it's all of these add together into our full defensive run save metric. And when you consider just the number of categories that we're analyzing in this metric, as well as the quality of the analysis, in my opinion, is really unparalleled. We're the only, to my knowledge, that's not at least out of the publicly available defensive metrics. We're the only one using the batted ball timer data to get a more objective read on the information of the batted ball's trajectory. So if that ball was in the air for 4.2 seconds, we're using that as a more objective way than saying, oh, that was just a medium hit fly ball. That gives us some more information, more objective information, and more relevant information as well to evaluating the difficulty of each play. So in terms of accuracy and in terms of just how comprehensive the metric is, I'd have to say our defensive run saved, in my mind, is the favorite.
God, you guys are like the NASA of baseball. That is amazing. Do you think more teams are utilizing defensive metrics now than there were, you know, even a few years ago?
You know, it's really hard for us to say. We supply defensive metrics. We work with a number of different major league teams. We're over half of major league teams, and it kind of varies year to year, but and some of those subscribe to our defensive metrics, and it's really hard to say exactly how they're using it and how they're implementing it. Obviously, we're still in business, so teams must see the value for it because they keep coming back for it. But I think there are a few things that you can kind of look at that suggest that they're really putting a lot of stock in it. Just looking at the players that are signed and traded for and just strategies that teams used. So if you look at a guy like Brendan Ryan, who ironically was just benched, I think, earlier this week, he's a guy that 10 years ago, I don't think anybody realizes the impact that he has on the game. In fact, we used to make fun of those guys. As a sabermetric community, we used to make fun of those guys because we didn't understand their defensive value. We didn't have a good way of measuring their full defensive value. And I'm sure there were guys 10 years ago that were just underrated because of that and maybe got overlooked. But you see a lot of those guys around. Clint Barmas is a similar kind of player where he's got excellent defensive abilities that really saved the Pirates a lot of runs every year, and the other teams that Barmas has been on as well. So, you know, I think that's evidence that teams are taking defensive metrics a little bit more seriously. And the other thing I'll say is the shift usage has been a kind of one of the things that we've stood on our soapbox and said, hey, you guys, all these teams should be shifting a lot more. It's really a good way to save runs. And that's really taken off the last couple of years. usage more than doubled from 2011 to 2012, which is pretty remarkable. And then it's actually the pace is up again this year so far. There have been more teams that are shifting at a higher rate than they have in the past years. So I think you're seeing evidence of it. There's little things that suggest that teams are paying attention to these defensive metrics and this kind of research.
Well, and it's, I'm glad that you brought that up too, because there's a whole chapter in the Fielding Bible, Volume 3, dedicated to defensive shifts. And as Pirates fans up in this region, we know Pedro Alvarez. He's a player that traditionally sees a lot of shifts. And in the chapter, you talk about the difference between defensive shifts and what more people are used to being traditionally called the shift, which I think is called the Ted Williams shift. Is that what it was called?
Yeah, we call it the Ted Williams shift, and then a non-Ted Williams shift or a partial Ted Williams shift, just to kind of to delineate between the shift where three infielders are completely on one side of the base versus maybe a little bit less extreme version where the shortstop might be playing essentially up the middle as opposed to completely on the right side.
So does Pedro Alvarez, do you have that data available? Does he see more of regular defensive shifts, or is he seeing more of the traditional Ted Williams shift?
He sees a mixture of them. It's about even for him, actually. And it's interesting, as the shift grows, teams are using both of those more often. They're using the partial Ted Williams shifts and the full Ted Williams shifts a little bit more often. A lot more often, honestly. And Alvarez sees a mixture of both of those. And, you know, we generally advocate for a full Ted Williams shift. I know teams are hesitant because, you know, that's a big gamble, right? It's very obvious that you're committing to playing towards his pull side. And if the guy goes the other way, you're leaving yourself vulnerable. So there's a huge risk. It's a huge risk reward situation. It's hard to just mentally overcome that and make that, that kind of risk. If you're a manager or if you're a player, I can understand where their hesitancy comes from, but I think you're seeing teams start to get better at playing in shifts. There's a whole mental aspect of, well, what do I do now that I'm on the other side of the field? How do I respond when there's a ball hit at me? How do I turn the double play from this angle as opposed to the angle I've grown up with my whole life, coming from the other side of second base? And I think teams are getting more comfortable with that, and they're working over their just mental adjustment to the shift.
And Jerry Hairston Jr. was just on MLB Network the other day talking about that, how different it is to be all of a sudden you're out in shallow right field like it's a beer league softball game and you're the rover, right? And just how different it is to field a ground ball, you know, 10 feet back in the grass instead of fielding the ball on the dirt and making the throw from there. Is there any way to beat the shift or shifts, any kind of shifts in general, consistently?
Oh, there are. It's tricky, though. There's the one obvious way is to bunt. And that's a skill that some guys have and some guys don't have. Carlos Pena is probably the guy that we actually mentioned in that chapter of the book you referenced. Carlos Pena has become proficient at bunting to beat the shift. In fact, he's laid down bunts with two strikes to beat the shift before. And that's become a real weapon of his, because he's actually one of the more extreme pull hitters in all of baseball. So if there's anybody who a shift is justified for, it's Carlos Pena, except for the fact that he has developed this weapon of bunting and laying down bunts fairly well, and he's able to beat them out quite often. So that's one way to beat it. The other way that's a lot harder to beat, or harder to execute, I'll say, is to learn to go the other way as a hitter. When hitters are this developed and this good at the major league level, it's usually because they've developed a certain swing plane and a certain swing that hits the ball really hard. And it's very difficult for a major league hitter. I think Mark Teixeira is probably a great example. He had some quotes in spring training of 2012 where he said, you know what, I'm sick of this shift. I'm just going to go the other way this year. And, well, he started thinking about it and trying to go the other way, and it wasn't really working out for him. He was sacrificing so much of what made him an effective hitter in the first place to go the other way. So that's a potential way to beat the shift that can actually turn into a negative for you if you can't execute it, if you're not the kind of hitter who's able to actually go the other way without completely destroying everything that made you an effective hitter in the first place.
Yeah, and I think it's neat that you mentioned that too, because a lot of times when we look at statistics, I think a lot of people take the person out of it. And it's easy to say, hey, why don't you just go ahead and hit the ball the other way?
Right.
But like when you know, these are swings that they've been developing since they're 6 years old. All of a sudden, you know, learning to take a ball and drive it in, you know, to the opposite field. That's a big adjustment when you have guys throwing 98 mile an hour BBs at you. So I think it's interesting that you brought that up, too. Now, I want to ask you this because you're talking about how you're looking at all these shifts and all these plays and everything. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys analyze every play from every game all season long, don't you?
Yes.
How do you even begin to approach cataloging all that data?
Well, we have a fantastic operations staff. Our guys have been doing this for years and years, and we have some customized software that our IT staff built and then has modified and added features to that allows us to just collect the information that we need. So, and then we take it into a database. But our operations staff is a pretty massive effort every season to cover every pitch of every game. And in fact, we go through every game several times, three or four times. We spend probably about 10 hours going through each game and just analyzing every bit and piece of that game. And collecting all the information, and it's a monumental task. And our operations crew has done a fantastic job since, you know, dating back to when the company started in 2002. And every year, as I mentioned before, we try to pride ourselves on collecting innovative and new kinds of information, and we keep adding to that operations workload. And it's certainly not an easy task for them to keep up with us, but they certainly do. They collect all the information and not only collect the information, but collect it at a high quality level. You know, if you're collecting this information and it's only so reliable, then the analysis and the results you're going to get from the analysis are going to be of questionable quality. And our operations group does a fantastic job collecting all that information and collecting it at a great standard for quality, and allows us to do a lot of great things with it and has a lot of value as evidenced by our success as a company.
That's pretty impressive to hear. I'm overwhelmed using Microsoft Excel, so that the fact that you guys are able to do all that with that technology is amazing to me. So any of those college graduates coming out of school, you guys have any interest in that stuff? Sounds like that's the place to go.
Absolutely. And I'll just throw in, it's just kind of a shameless plug here, but we've got a lot of our video scouts have graduated on to bigger and better things. A lot of them have prominent roles with major league teams now, and when we talk to them from time to time, a few times a year, they always come back and say, a few of them in particular have come back and said, you know, that summer at BIS that I spent pouring through video of baseball games was the best pure baseball learning experience of my entire baseball career at this point, which, you know, really is kind of an amazing statement now that they're on to such bigger and better things. But it's a lot of baseball, and these guys they're already experts when they get here, and they just become that much more proficient in it. And it's a fantastic experience for someone coming out of school and wants to get into the industry.
Well, I have to ask you this, Ben, because this has been bothering me for a while now. I read one of your articles. I think it's one of the best articles that I've ever read. It completely kind of changed the way that I started to look at things. But it hit a little sore spot, I'm not going to lie, because I'm a Pirates fan. So last year you wrote an article about the Gold Glove winners, and I forget exactly how you phrased it, but it was basically like guys who are deserving of Gold Gloves and guys who got Gold Gloves that maybe didn't deserve the award for what it was. And so as a Pirates fan, I saw Andrew McCutchen was on the wrong end of that Gold Glove award there, because I guess statistically speaking, he's not one of the better defensive players that's out there. And I guess I just wanted to know what makes a guy... Like, when you look at Andrew McCutchen, he looks like a good defender. You know, he makes those great diving catches and, you know, leaps against the wall. So what makes a guy look like a great defensive outfielder but not statistically show up like that?
You know, the McCutchen example is a really interesting one, and actually the timing here is kind of perfect. My colleague Scott Spratt is writing about the Pirates this week for ESPN.com, so that'll be up over the weekend, I think on Sunday, but... And McCutchen is one of the topics that he's writing about, one of the players he's writing about. McCutchen's a really interesting example of a guy who is obviously very athletic, and you guys see it, everybody sees it, and it's evidenced in his batting line, it's evidenced in his great defense that you see on a regular basis. What when he first came up, he had a habit of, I wonder if you guys, maybe you guys can back me up here, or maybe you noticed this on your own. He played very shallow.
Yeah.
And in fact, it helped him save a few singles, you know, on shallow hit balls. But he got beat over his head, especially with the Pirates pitching staff at the time who were giving up deep fly balls. Those are obviously turning into doubles and triples, which are more costly than the singles that he was saving in the first place by playing so shallow. So our metric doesn't you know, say, hey, McCutcheon's a great athletic guy, let's rate him really well. It says, well, he might be saving a few singles, but those aren't saving as many runs as the doubles and the triples that he's giving up over his head. So our metrics actually, his first couple of years, his first year or two in the big leagues, had him very negative in that regard because of those extra base hits. But since then, the Pirates have their coaching staff, to give them credit, has worked with him to improve his positioning, to play a little bit more deep in the outfield. In fact, I was watching a Pirates game just a week or so ago, and it was against the Cardinals, where John Jay was playing extremely shallow, and McCutcheon was the exact opposite. He was playing very deep, especially compared to John Jay. And it came up. It cost John Jay on at least one extra base hit, and McCutcheon was gliding easily over to make those plays on the deep fly balls to center field. So McCutcheon, actually, in the last couple of years, his numbers have taken a big step forward. He's gone from a below-average fielder in terms of defensive runs saved to about an average, maybe even a little bit above average by our metric. So he's certainly not a bad fielder. I don't mean to say that he's, you know, completely undeserving. I think last year in the National League, there was a runaway winner, according to our defensive metrics, Michael Bourne. He was just covering so much ground, especially saving those deep balls in the outfield for Atlanta. You know, Atlanta's outfield, just by the way, had a fantastic defensive season between Prado out there in left and Hayward in right, and anchored by Bourne in center field. And, you know, that was just a tremendous outfield, and Bourne was kind of the leader of that. So that's probably more of where the what is interpreted as anti-McCutcheon argument comes from. It's more of Bourne was just that much better. He was just that good.
All right, well, I'm going to let all the media outlets around here know that they can get off the Ben Jedlovic hating bandwagon now. It's not there is no personal vendetta against Andrew McCutcheon.
Certainly not.
That's good to know. And that was part one of the Ben Jedlovic interview. It was this guy is amazing. I compared it to talking to Google. That's what it was like. Like, you give this guy a question and he gives you the most detailed, amazing answer. He's going to be an awesome someday when he's an old man. And he's sitting on his porch in his rocking chair, and you just sit down and talk to him, it's going to be like the coolest experience for someone, getting to talk to this guy, because he has such a wealth of knowledge. It's amazing, and I'm really excited to get part two out there as well for people to listen to as soon as we have that out there. Well, that's going to be it for us this week. We'd like to thank our listeners, and we'd like to, again, ask if you're listening to us on iTunes, please give us a rate and review. Thanks to Dr. Garrett for coming in. Thanks to Jason for his update with the tribe. A huge thanks to Ben Jedlovic for part one today. If you want to check us out on the internet, you can at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter @tristatebb. And you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/tsmbaseball. So for Dr. Garrett Britton, Jason Ruggiero, and Ben Jedlovic this week, this is Andy Burdick, and we can't wait to talk to you next week. Yeah.